Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We explore the fascinating figure of Alexander Hamilton today, courtesy of a very interesting new book called Alexander Hamilton, Revolutionary. The author is Martha Brokenbrough, and she has written some critically acclaimed novels for young adult readers. And there are some ways in which this book also seems perhaps geared to slightly younger readers. We'll ask her about that in just a moment. But even if that was at least part of the intent, I think anybody of any age would find this book thoroughly fascinating and enlightening. I certainly did. And I'm very pleased to be able to speak with Martha Brokenbrough for the next few minutes about her book and about the experience of writing about this endlessly fascinating figure. Martha Brokenbrough, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me ask you that first question right off the bat. Was this a book that you intended for young readers?
It is. This is one of those young adult titles. YA is what we call it. And it's the first young adult biography of Alexander Hamilton. There are ones for younger children still. And then, of course, there are many, many books written for serious historians and adults. This is one of the first books that really focuses on Hamilton for readers 12 and up, and certainly older people can enjoy it. But it's meant to be a really accessible, compelling, and exciting read for people who want to know more about this founding father.
I think you've really achieved that, and I want to reiterate that I enjoyed it thoroughly, and at no point as I was reading it did I even really have that much of a sense that I was reading a book that in any way was sort of, you know, dumbed down or simplified for younger readers. I think it's a very rich, compelling portrait you draw of Alexander Hamilton. One of the clues to this perhaps being intended for younger readers is sort of the appearance of the book. That is, the way many of the pages are laid out, and the extent to which we have images alongside the text. And the images are utilized in really interesting fashion. Describe to our listeners, if you would, what they see when they open up this book, and what kind of decisions or choices were part of that.
Well, so the publisher, Jean Fywell at Fywell & Friends, and I set out to make a really beautiful object. Books have often been beautiful, and historically they were really, really beautiful. And so we were trying to bring some of that feeling back. And so you're going to see portraits of the people who played big roles in Alexander Hamilton's life. You will see maps showing where he lived and where he traveled during the Revolutionary War. You'll also see some artifacts. I found Alexander Hamilton and Eliza's wedding ring, the ring that he gave to his wife when they got married, and I was struck by how incredibly modern this ring looked. It was these two slim bands that swung open, and on the inside, their names and the year of their wedding were engraved. And so what I wanted to do was make something beautiful, but also something that brought these people back to life. Sometimes history becomes so dry and dull, and we think of dates and timelines and this and that. History is people. It's people and their relationships with each other and the choices they made and the hardships and triumphs that they experienced. And I cannot think of a man who had a more interesting life than Alexander Hamilton.
And he certainly had an incredibly difficult childhood. This was one thing about Alexander Hamilton's life that I knew next to nothing about. And clearly it was important to you that the reader come away with a very powerful sense of just all that he endured as a young child and well into his teens. Describe the scope of the unhappiness and difficulty which he had to endure.
Oh, he endured so much unhappiness and difficulty. You know, starting from the circumstances of his birth, his parents were not married to each other. His mother had been married before. She left her husband. She hated being married to this guy. And she left her husband and the son they had together. And she was put into jail as a result of this, and because she had had relationships with other men afterward. So when Alexander Hamilton and his brother came into the world, they were already at a tremendous disadvantage. Hamilton wasn't allowed to go to school, and so he had to educate himself with the books that he had. And this is what he did. He was a really incredibly bright guy. He knew French, thanks to his mother. He also became a tremendous writer. And so after his mother died, after his father left the family, a storm, a hurricane, much like the ones we've been reading about in the news, hit the West Indies. And it was the worst hurricane of that had been recorded at the time. And Alexander Hamilton wrote a letter about it to his dad, who he missed, his dad who left him, his dad who he never saw again afterward. He wrote a letter to him, and that letter was published anonymously in the newspaper, and it was so compelling that people wanted to know who wrote that letter. And when they found out it was just a boy, they took together a collection. They created a scholarship fund, and thanks to his boss at the time, he had a job working at a shipping company. Thanks to his boss, he was sent to New York to go to school.
Mm. One specific point about his childhood that you've already touched on, but I think is worth just talking about for a moment, is the kind of shame that was very publicly assigned to children who were born under the circumstances under which, for instance, Alexander was born. Describe what such a child would be called in a, for instance, in a court of law, for instance, in the divorce proceedings, how they were designated.
They were referred to as whore children. And, you know, what a terrible thing. I mean, he and his brother were, I think, 10 and 12 years old at the time. And, you know, to be called that when you just want a chance to, you know, live your life and be loved and have opportunity. Alexander Hamilton used to read Plutarch's Lives, and he would read about heroic men, and he wanted to be a hero. And so how do you, when you are known as the son of a whore, how do you become heroic?
Hmm. We are speaking with Martha Brokenbrough and talking about her book, Alexander Hamilton, Revolutionary. Describe the city of New York to which he traveled in 1772 and what kind of opportunities it afforded him.
Well, you know, we think now of New York as one of the great cities in the world. It was on its way to being that then, but it wasn't quite there yet. When he arrived in New York, it was certainly bigger than what he was used to in the West Indies. But it was also, you know, getting on to be winter, and that winter that he arrived was freezing cold. You know, here's a kid who grew up not needing to wear shoes, and suddenly, you know, he's in New York during a bitterly cold winter. So you'd think that, boy, what a transition that would be, and he might have some struggles. Not at all. He had letters of introduction to some important people, and he also met a man named Hercules Mulligan, who would become an important and influential friend for him. Hercules Mulligan's brother worked at Courtright and Company, and that was where, that's the parent company of where Alexander Hamilton worked as a teenager as a shipping clerk. And Hercules Mulligan was an Irish tailor. and he was an immigrant. He had come to New York when he was 7 years old, and he was working as a tailor, and he was also a member of the Sons of Liberty. And the Sons of Liberty was a patriot group that did all sorts of things to resist what colonists considered undue and unjust British influence. You know, the most famous Sons of Liberty event was the Boston Tea Party. So Hercules Mulligan was one of those people, and he was very influential with Alexander Hamilton, and he was so proud of who Hamilton became. That was one of the things in the research, you know, reading what Hercules Mulligan wrote about him. It wasn't all true, but it was written with great love.
Absolutely. So Alexander Hamilton, of course, is coming on the scene at a time when all kinds of efforts are underway to either defer the tyranny of Britain or to throw off those shackles altogether. Describe the dramatic next step in the Alexander Hamilton story and the way that it intersected with this vying for independence.
Well, so Alexander Hamilton's first order of business when he came to the colonies was to finish his education. So he went to New Jersey, and at a school there, he finished the equivalence of what high school would be. He really wanted to go to what would become Princeton University. He wanted to go there, and like Aaron Burr, he wanted to graduate quickly. Alexander Hamilton was absolutely in a rush to get on with the business of heroics. He was turned down by this school, and you know, they said that you cannot rush your way through. That's counter to the mission of this institution. So he went elsewhere. He went to King's College, which became Columbia, and he did engage in a course of study there. And this is when he began his political writing and his political career, arguing about liberty. Now, the president of his college was a loyalist, and so this is where we got to see Alexander Hamilton in conflict with authority figures. And so, you know, I like to imagine that he and Miles Cooper, who was the president of the college, you know, having vigorous debates together. When the war did break out, this is after Lexington, a mob gathered in New York and came for Miles Cooper. So here is a young Alexander Hamilton standing on the steps of his college trying to hold back this mob. Even though he agreed with their opinions, he was trying to hold back the mob as they came for his professor. Now, it's unclear whether his professor knew that Hamilton was on his side, because, you know, some of the accounts say that Miles Cooper was yelling out the window, "Don't listen to that guy." But in fact, you know, that helped buy time for Miles Cooper to escape. And, you know, that was who Alexander Hamilton was. He had his opinions, but he also knew what the right thing was to do.
You write, even though he disagreed with Cooper politically, Alexander was more than willing to stand as a human shield when it was the right thing to do. He could have been beaten to death. He could have lost his stature as the young voice of the revolution. But none of that mattered to him as much as human decency. Honor, of course, was very important to Alexander Hamilton, as we continue to learn the more we explore his story. He is hungry for glory on the battlefield, but actually he ends up, at least initially, serving the Revolutionary War cause in a very different way. I mean, serving the effort, but in a sense behind a desk more than anything. Describe the invitation that came from one George Washington.
Well, so this was, you know, after a miserable winter, the crossing of the Delaware. Alexander Hamilton was sick. He had been bedridden. He made that crossing. And, you know, this is after serving very capably as an artillery captain. He was so capable that other generals wanted him to come work as their aides, and he turned them down until he got that offer from Washington. And was it partly because he didn't feel good, or was it, you know, the chance to work with George Washington? I don't think we'll ever really know, but he did spend the next 4 years of the war becoming George Washington's right-hand man. And he did have occasional military exploits. There was one exploit on the Schuylkill River where Alexander led a group of men to make sure British people didn't, the enemy didn't have access to a flour mill. And as they came under fire, Alexander and his men ran off to a boat that was their means of escape. And as they were being shot at, and, you know, one man was killed, and, you know, Alexander leapt into the river, and he was believed dead. You know, here's this guy, he's got his desk job, but, you know, he was believed killed in action, and word of his death made it back to George Washington's camp just before a soaking wet Alexander Hamilton arrived. And they were, of course, very glad to see him alive. But for the most part, Hamilton was doing a lot of writing for George Washington. During the famous and horrible winter at Valley Forge, this is when Baron von Steuben arrived, at, the famous European military leader. And so he, von Steuben, helped train the soldiers, and he worked with Alexander Hamilton to write the Army's first manual that, you know, was used for a surprisingly long time.
Hmm. And I love one line you you write in this this chapter where you're talking about Valley Forge. You write, "From his seat at the center of war, Alexander saw clearly that defeat could ride up on many horses." You're speaking, of course, of the very all too real reality that the Americans were facing all kinds of very, very serious issues, even beyond their British opponents. And Alexander Hamilton obviously played a very important role in helping to keep this army together and to secure for it some of the resources it so desperately needed to carry on this this battle with the British.
It's true. People were starving. They, you know, first of all, there were certainly, you know, there are many patriots, but there are also many loyalists, and sometimes these people were in the same family. And, you know, you couldn't just say, oh, because, you know, we're on American soil that we can have the food from this farm. They would often say, no, you know, we can get more money from the British. The British had uniforms. They had guns, they had artillery, they had all these resources that we didn't. And I think, you know, we think about the army and kind of our modern army comes to mind. Well, there was not really, you know, there was the Continental Army, but there was no standing army, and there were state militias. And so there was a lot of tension between Congress and between the states. And who do you pay first? Do you pay the state militias? Do you pay the Continental Army? There was no means of raising tax money. So how did we pay the soldiers? And in fact, many of them were given IOUs. They weren't paid at all. And so until the French entered the war, they're also, you know, they had to melt down statues and roofs and windowsills, the lead from rooftops and windowsills and statues to make ammunition. You know, this was the way to win the war. I think Hamilton knew that, yes, part of it would happen on the battlefield, but also a lot of it happened in desks and making cases for funding. And it was, it absolutely took everything out of these men.
Mm. Well, Alexander Hamilton ultimately makes a difference not only behind a desk, but also on the battlefield, as we read in your book. Ultimately, some of the most important work that Alexander Hamilton does is to help point the way to what this new nation should look like and how it should function. He wrote a series of Continentalist essays, you tell us, continuing to explain how a federal government should look. At the outset of the war, no one had any idea how to establish a governing body for a new independent nation. Anyone who said otherwise was kidding themselves. People were used to living life as colonists. They had to be led into a new world. Explain that new world and the difference that Alexander Hamilton made in helping point these young Americans towards a vision of how this new nation could function?
Well, I think, you know, one of the big questions is, are you a citizen of your state or are you a citizen of the nation? And I think, you know, all of us who live in the United States now, we definitely think of ourselves as Americans. That identity was not how people thought of themselves then. You would think, oh, you know, I'm a Virginian, and Virginia happens to be part of this confederation of states. And so Alexander Hamilton saw greater potential for this. And interestingly, so did Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin predicted that Europe would, you know, maybe someday together and form the European Union. It's fascinating to see how visionary these men were. But part of the job was to make the case that these states, if they had an energetic federal government and strong federal leadership, would be better off. And that was a hard case to make. You know, states were of different sizes. They had different populations. They had different influence. And one thing that's true about people is that when they have power, they want to keep their power and they don't want to share it. And sharing and compromise was part of the deal. You know, one of the first big questions is, how do we pay the debt from this Revolutionary War? How do we pay our soldiers? And the states that didn't have debt didn't want to chip in to the cause on behalf of the nation as a whole. And that was the assumption of debt by the federal government was one of the first big compromises that Alexander Hamilton helped hammer out.
Right. You write at one point, in short, the United States had to start acting like a nation and not a flimsy confederation of states. You not only explore this in great detail, but also something that I had not known so much about, namely how Alexander Hamilton, again, as a man of honor and integrity, was a crucial figure in how this new nation took up the matter of how to treat those who had been loyalists, those who had remained loyal to Britain. Explain what Alexander Hamilton believed about this very important matter.
Well, he believed that, you know, even though they had been loyalists and had arguably chosen the wrong side, that they were still Americans and they still had rights. There were a lot of people really angry at the loyalists. And Hercules Mulligan, who I mentioned earlier, he had worked, so New York was occupied, and he had worked as a tailor and as a spy. And part of his spy work even saved George Washington's life. Well, people thought that Hercules Mulligan was a loyalist, and George Washington had to have breakfast with him when he came back to New York when the British left the city to show them that, in fact, no, he wasn't, you know, and he was actually a hero. But there was a great deal of anger, and so Alexander Hamilton, even though he had been one of the most ardent revolutionaries, represented the loyalists in court. And I think, again, you know, this shows that here is a man who has principles. These people don't lose their rights just because they make the wrong decision.
Hmm. What kind of difference did Alexander Hamilton ultimately make in the shaping of this new nation, its government, and also its financial system?
Well, you know, how many times a year do you think you use the services of a bank? You know, all of us, you know, we go to ATMs, we get out our money. Many of us have taken out loans so that we can start businesses, buy homes, buy cars. This is all because of Alexander Hamilton. So one of his chief rivals was Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was so anti-bank that at one point he said that anybody who so much works as a bank should be, you know, charged with treason. Treason is a crime punishable by death. So Thomas Jefferson was basically saying banks are so horrible that we should put bank tellers to death. And, you know, I say this with a little bit of a chuckle in my voice, but it's true. There was initially great resistance to the idea of banks, and yet we could not have this nation without a banking system. Does the banking system have some flaws? Yes, you could make that argument, but without that banking system, what would we be? We would be a nation of farmers and land would be the only wealth. Well, land is a finite resource, so that's something that is, you know, inherently an undemocratic way of doing things. And so for all the people who accuse Hamilton of being elitist, you know, I think that the banking system is a pretty democratic institution.
Pretty amazing. There's all kinds of other things we could talk about, but there's one other matter that I think is worth talking about that I think very seldom gets mentioned, namely that Alexander Hamilton had at least a modest role to play behind the scenes in the fact that George Washington was elected our first president. That was something that he was really desperate to have occur. He wanted Washington as the first president and not John Adams. Just say a word about Alexander Hamilton behind the scenes, helping to make certain that Washington would be the first president.
Well, Hamilton did a lot of stuff behind the scenes and, you know, wrote a lot of letters and was influential. But it was his relationship with Washington that George Washington didn't want to be president. I read some of his diary entries, and he talked about how he just wanted to be a farmer in Mount Vernon. And so, you know, Hamilton said, it really has to be you. And why did it have to be George Washington? Well, this was the man who had, you know, led the nation to victory. This was the guy, you know, who led the Continental Army. And, you know, he did it in spite of cabals against him. There was a group of people who wanted to unseat him. George Washington had wisdom. He was a good listener. And I think also Hamilton knew that he could persuade Washington of certain things. And he had definite ideas about the finances of the nation. And with Thomas Jefferson as the Secretary of State, you know, Thomas Jefferson really had an opposite idea. And Hamilton wanted to make sure that, you know, the nation did the right thing. George Washington was also elected unanimously twice, the only person ever to have that honor.
Well, there is much more to the incredible story of Alexander Hamilton, including his marriage to an extraordinary woman, and of course also the very sad end to Alexander Hamilton's life in a pistol duel with his longtime rival and frequent antagonist, Aaron Burr. We can read about all of that and much, much more in your endlessly compelling book, which again is called Alexander Hamilton, Revolutionary, published by Fywell and Friends, and the author, Martha Brokenbro. Martha Brokenbro, congratulations on writing this wonderful book, and thank you for making time for this conversation.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. It seems fitting somehow as we approach the Thanksgiving holiday that we take a look at one of the most important documents that is one of the foundations for our nation and how it functions, our own Constitution. I have very much enjoyed over the last few days an intriguing book called Constitution Cafe, Jefferson's Brew for a True Revolution. It's a book which examines the Constitution and how it was written and how it is altered over the years. And it is the contention of the author of this book, Christopher Phillips, that there is something to be said for the very tantalizing notion of changing the Constitution perhaps more dramatically and more often. That is the notion of revisiting the Constitution on a fairly regular basis and of looking very closely and, in a sense, skeptically at how it is put together and how it is serving or perhaps not serving the best interests of our nation and of its citizens. And towards that end, Christopher Phillips has convened a number of discussion groups in line with the notion of the Socrates Cafe. and hence the title of this book, Constitution Cafe. And it's published by W.W. Norton & Company. And we have Christopher Phillips with us for the next few minutes to talk about the Constitution and his thoughts about it. Christopher Phillips, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much.
So glad to be talking with you. Tell us what first drew you to the U.S. Constitution and to examine it in the way that you have. I mean, examining it in a way that has ultimately led to all of these fascinating discussions about it.
Well, as you touched on, I had been holding these philosophy discussion groups called Socrates Cafe for the last 15 years. And what I noticed in the last few years was that people wanted to talk politics. They didn't really know how to do so thoughtfully among diverse groups where people didn't see eye to eye. It's one thing to engage philosophically and really consider a wide variety of notions. It's another thing to do so on political issues, I have found. And so, well, what was interesting is that everybody thought, you know, that the current system of governance, those we elect, that it's totally dysfunctional. And yet if you ask them if the Constitution itself is a culprit, they say no. Basically, they think the Constitution is fine and dandy. So there might be a disconnect between that. The other thing is that you ask people, well, have you read the Constitution? Virtually everybody shakes their head, from the most well-to-do to those who are rather down and out, and say, well, no, I haven't. So a big part of the Constitution Cafe project that builds on an idea of Thomas Jefferson's, who proposed that we shouldn't look at the Constitution as some work of divine inspiration that's rather sacrosanct, but that we should consider an evolving organic document. In fact, so much so that if Jefferson had his way, there'd be an amendment in our Constitution that says we should consider rewriting it from scratch every 20 years so that every new generation comes up with its own scaffolding for governance, its own system of rights and responsibilities. I decided to at least apply that idea of Jefferson's in an imaginative way today, at a time when Americans across the political spectrum are deeply disgruntled, to say the least. In fact, I think it's not too strong language to say that they believe that, as the Declaration put it, government is becoming destructive to the ends of the pursuit of, you know, of happiness, of life and liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So I asked myself, could the Constitution be playing a part as an impediment rather than a facilitator of a higher democratic hopes and dreams? Or at the very least, should we immerse ourselves in and ask ourselves what, if anything, would we change and why? And would that lead to discoveries about what our higher hopes and dreams are for democracy today?
You give us all kinds of excerpts from these conversations, and at least to judge from what we see in the book, these had to be really lively, interesting conversations. Have you just given us, in a sense, the high points, or in fact, were these discussions as rich and fascinating as they appear to be from these the evidence of these excerpts?
If anything, I probably didn't do justice to the richness of them. It's really difficult, as Plato, who was a scribe of Socrates, you know, you do try to filter things in a way that captures the substance, the tone, and the tenor of dialogues that were considerably longer. And you do have to use the art of writing in ways that somehow does that. What I found again and again and again was that if you set a tone of reasonableness, where the idea is not to browbeat and interrupt, and you know, but to give people a chance to share their stories, to develop their political viewpoints, as with the Constitution itself as a conversational springboard for that, where you're inspired to really take the time to listen to why people are coming from where they're coming from. Some amazing ideas evolve out of that if we have enough faith in one another to just allow ourselves to share why we think what we do. What typically emerges from that is the quite unlikeliest of bedfellows will discover that they have common ground, even what I might call higher ground. But in order for that to take place, there has to be a type of dialogue that is equal parts reasonableness, thoughtfulness, and imaginativeness. And of course, that requires an element of empathy among participants. Now, I've been doing this in some very interesting places and spaces with the Socrates Cafe for a long time, so I'm fairly inured to how to get people who are different to talk to one another in a way that celebrates difference rather than makes it a stigma, which has been all the rage these days in America. So So again, I hope I even did, you know, the merest justice to the live dialogues that actually took part.
Part of what is at the heart of this book is Thomas Jefferson's dissatisfaction to some extent with the U.S. Constitution as it was drafted, and some of his thoughts on how the Constitution could be very effectively revisited on a regular basis. Ahead of us talking about that, I wonder if you could just say a word about the framing of the Constitution, and in particular, who framed the Constitution, because that has a lot to do with all this.
Well, you know, it's interesting, number one, that the so-called founding fathers, the signing of the Declaration of Independence, were pretty much absent with that, you know, AWOL when it came to taking part in the Constitutional Convention. Only 8 of our founding fathers who signed the Declaration actually took part in the framing. Jefferson himself was across the water serving as U.S. Minister to France. So, you know, the Declaration was a galvanizing document. The Constitution was meant to rein people in, create a more centralized form of governance, maybe before they were ready to do so. The fact of the matter is that the Constitutional Convention was held behind closed doors. There was no public record of the proceedings. Jefferson found that anathema. The other fact is that, for worse or for better, the framers were a bunch of well-to-do white guys, not in any way, shape, or form reflective of the American populace as a whole. The other thing is that they never really asked people if they wanted a Republican form of government, much less what kind of Republican form of government that they might want. So these things, and the other thing is, you know, our original Constitution was the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. It had the hard and fast stipulation that in order to have any changes made to it, all 13 states or delegates from all 13 states had to agree to it. Yet when the Constitutional Convention was called to rewrite the Constitution in Philadelphia in 1787, only 12 of 13 states even showed up. Rhode Island refused to even send delegates because they smelled a rat. So you could argue that the Constitutional Convention was rather unconstitutional. So all of these things in the mix show that, look, it's an amazing document. I appreciate more than ever the feat of our framers. And yet I think these are flawed and foibled men. And if we have Jeffersonian faith that the Constitution can evolve, that the human mind and heart can evolve in tandem with it, then we shouldn't be afraid to periodically revise it, or at least to consider periodically revising it.
Hmm. You write at one point, Jefferson not only proposed his own ideas for ensuring that the Constitution's governing blueprint perpetuated the democratic experiment, but he proposed in all seriousness that every generation of Americans have a chance to create society anew by rewriting the Constitution from scratch, formulating new foundational laws that suit the change in circumstances as well as men, recommending 20-year intervals. So it's one thing what you just said about revisiting the Constitution and perhaps making it a slightly simpler process to amend it. It's another thing to go as far as Jefferson is suggesting. Talk a moment about Jefferson's suggestion, if you think it was made in full seriousness, and if such a practice were to be adopted, which is, of course, a pretty far-fetched notion, I think, in this day and age especially, but what that would look like.
Well, the first thing to keep in mind is that none of the framers of the Constitution considered themselves iconic, and so none of them considered the document that they were working on something that would be fixed or relatively fixed for all time. If you look at, even consider that, I mean, even James Madison himself, the so-called father of the Constitution, he would be absolutely stunned by how little it has been changed over time. I would argue that he might even be dismayed. The fact of the matter is that since the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, it's only been amended 17 times. The last time was in 1992, the 27th Amendment, which dealt with congressional pay raises. And that was an amendment that actually was approved by Congress to be considered by the states way back in 1789. That was our very last amendment ever considered and approved. Jefferson felt that the amendment process that was put into place by our framers was way too labyrinthine, was way too difficult, and that it inhibited the type of flexibility that was needed to make the Constitution an organic document. So again, I think at this point, so much time has passed in the, that, you know, even if we consider the Constitution rather a mirror of society where, you know, we're afraid to experiment anymore. You know, we like the fact that it's rather ossified. But as more and more people across the political spectrum come to feel that our system of governance is woefully dysfunctional, as they come to feel that those in all three branches of government do not abide by the dictates or the strictures of the existing Constitution, I think at the very least that we might consider asking ourselves, as I do in Constitution Cafe, what would we change if we could? I know a lot of people are already calling for new constitutional conventions and this and that. I think that's way too premature. I think first we'd need to educate ourselves about the existing document and really ask ourselves among in diverse groups and in really cool public places and spaces what we would change and why, and see if we can reach some sort of consensus and common ground before we even consider going that next step and bringing about genuine constitutional change.
Right. One of the ways you frame this question that really got me thinking and also frankly got me a little less kind of nervous. I mean, when I as I was just rereading Jefferson's words aloud that I just shared a minute or two ago, I mean, I felt my heart kind of racing a little bit in terms of wow, this isn't so radical. I mean, and I just imagined even more so than how I'm reacting, how a lot of other people would react to that notion of, in a sense, shaking the very foundations upon which our nation was built.
Yeah.
A way that you frame that same notion that is a little friendlier, a little less frightening.
Well, let me say this, though. Even the most conservative among the framers was deeply radical. I mean, the revolutionary spirit was part of their DNA. We've lost that. These people were willing to risk everything, to put everything on the line, to start a new form of being in the world, a new democratic community. So we have now adopted the play it safe mode. No matter how dysfunctional things are, we're afraid to change things. So if we could recapture that ethos and that revolutionary spirit of the founders, I think they would think we're doing them a grave disservice by playing it safe and resting on their laurels.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I think you do a real service to that cause by framing that question in slightly less radical language, because I mean, rather than having intellectual doors sort of slammed in your face, I mean, by certain people who do not immediately gravitate to that possibility, it becomes a little more inviting, for instance, when you ask, if we were the framers, what would our Constitution look like?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a great question wherever you are on either side of the aisle. If we were the framers, what would our Constitution look like? And in a sense, that's what all of these discussions are about and what your book is about.
That's exactly right. And one thing that this project is accomplishing is it's building bonds of caring and trust among people who don't see things eye to eye. So it is that Tea Party sympathizers and MoveOn.org sympathizers might actually discover, as I note in my book, that they have common ground. They may disagree on every concrete policy solution under the sun, but they both may agree that the First Amendment clause that says Congress shall not abridge people's right to petition Congress or to petition for redress of grievance is attenuated, that it needs to be beefed up so that when we petition government for redress, that they actually have to address our grievance, that they can't just slip our grievance in a desk drawer and forget all about it. So much angst and anger across the board because government is considered not just unresponsive but destructive to the ends of an evolving democracy. But you can channel that through asking yourself, what would I change if I could, and how would I make it so government could not be destructive to the ends of democracy, even if it wanted to? And that's the kind of common ground that's being discovered among really motley people in these types of dialogues.
Wow. And, of course, you're exploring some really, in a sense, complicated questions like, what really does it mean in terms of the common good versus the commonwealth?
Yeah.
Some of the contentious points that are part of the Constitution that,
right,
have people in raging arguments, you have found a way to approach some of these questions in a much more constructive fashion. Are you surprised that this has, in fact, ensued as it has?
Well, I'm pleasantly pleased, let me put it that way, but I had to think of a way beforehand to create a way of engaging in discourse on political issues that actually almost forced people to step back, because the whole idea was not to just start tackling hot-button issues where people clearly would just jump down one another's throats. But so we ask ourselves, okay, for instance, the dialogue you just mentioned, where I met with people in the Mall of America in the food court section, where we looked at Congress's authority to, you know, provide for the general welfare. Again, people across the political spectrum are enraged that Congress is providing things for itself that are not necessarily being provided to the greater part of the American populace. Is that promoting or providing for the general welfare? Arguably not. And so all they said was, in this new tweaked Constitution Cafe article, was that in promoting the general welfare, and I'm paraphrasing, Congress shall not provide for itself goods that it does not provide for the rest of the American people. Because, again, you have this very small percentage who has complete control over the purse strings who would deny the overwhelming majority of Americans things that it willingly gives to itself, from, you know, really good health care, which all federal workers get, granted, but that anyone in the private sector would give their eye teeth for. Yes, Congress does pay into the Social Security system, but they get Social Security back in addition to federal retirement benefits as well. These are things that, again, most Americans would just give anything for, but any time these things are considered, Congress suddenly becomes very parsimonious. So what would be wrong just by reining in Congress's authority? If it's really going to promote the general welfare rather than the congressional welfare, then it seems to me that this would give it more bite, that they'd have to be reined in some.
Well, that gives our listeners at least a hint of the fascinating, provocative ideas that are shared in this interesting book called Constitution Cafe, Jefferson's Brew for a True Revolution, published by W.W. Norton & Company and the author, Christopher Phillips. Christopher Phillips, thank you so much for joining me and for writing this very, very interesting book.
Oh, thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll spend most of our time with Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, who is the director of choral activities at Carthage College and chairman of the music department, on the eve of homecoming at Carthage. And Saturday night's homecoming concert at Carthage is going to include a celebration of the Carthage Choir's 90th anniversary. We'll be talking with Dr. Garcia Novelli about his own career as a choral conductor and the long, impressive history of the Carthage Choir itself. We'll also be speaking briefly with sports writer Mike Lupica about his latest book, a novel for young readers called Lone Stars. On Friday, paying his monthly visit to the program, will be Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. Support for The Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed